This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Liberia, the wheels of justice skid to a stop. Many rape victims can't get to clinics or to court. In Nepal, we learn the fine points of sharing a communal water tap.
Rule number 3. The virtual line is enforced through joint regulation. Cheaters are handled with varying degrees of severity, depending on their age, status, and ferocity. I lack all 3 of these advantages. So for me, outright cheating is not an option.
Music, let's go.
And traditional Haitian dance is alive and well in Boston.
The first day I went and see drums in front of me and they started to play. It was like you went straight to heaven. It was a house of joy.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer.
Global warming knows no borders. It does not discriminate. It affects us all.
That was Danish Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen at the climate change conference in Copenhagen. The people of Nepal know exactly what he means. Their tiny country has one of the lowest carbon emission rates in the world. But they see the effects of global warming firsthand. They only have to look at the Himalayan mountains all around them. Glaciers that have been there for hundreds of years are disappearing at an alarmingly rapid rate. Jared Ferry has more.
On a stone platform in the mountainside village of Dunche, Nepal, women and girls are refining the season's wheat harvest. They pound the dried plants and sift them through a screen to separate the wheat from the chaff. They work against a backdrop that could come straight from the pages of National Geographic. Below us, terraced fields are chopped into the mountainside like giant steps down into the river valley. Towering in the distance are the Himalayas, their snow-capped peaks shining in the afternoon sun. But for all its beauty, there's something wrong with this picture. Wangal Tamang, a farmer, says he only managed to grow enough food to feed his family for 2 months.
This year is not good. Not raining. Now it's very difficult. In the past, they have a food. Now it's not raining. They do not have a food.
This past growing season has been particularly bad as Nepal was hit with a major drought. But there's also a larger underlying problem here that's compounding the water shortage. Community leader Lakpa Tamang says he's noticed the climate heating up over the past couple of decades.
I thought it's getting warm because 20 years ago in Dunche, this place is very cold. Early in the morning, we could not wash our face and we could not wash our body. But now, early in the morning, the water is not as cold as before.
Global warming is not only playing havoc with weather patterns in Nepal. According to a recent Oxfam report, it's shifting traditional growing seasons and making rainfall more erratic, which makes it harder for subsistence farmers to feed their families. It's also causing the ice on the mountains to melt. Samjwal Bacharya is a scientist at the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development in Kathmandu. He's been keeping close tabs on shrinking glaciers in the Himalayas.
On the basis of the mapping of the glaciers based on the different satellite images, we found the glaciers are retreating 10 meter to 60 meter per year. And the fastest glacier retreating we found 74 meter per year.
Scientists predict that rising temperatures in the Himalayas will eventually affect at least 1.3 billion people, those who depend on the yearly glacial melt for their water source. Major rivers, including the Mekong in Southeast Asia, the Ganges in India, and the Yangtze in China, start in the Himalayas. Every spring they're fed by the runoff from glaciers there. Bajracharya likens the Himalayas to a solid water reservoir for all of Asia. He says if the glaciers keep shrinking, so will the rivers.
So it is out of imagination that such a huge population, it is dependent with the freshwater resources, which is derived from the glacier melt. So I cannot imagine the problem. I cannot imagine.
In the village of Dunche, Lakpa, the community leader, says climate change is already transforming the way people have lived for generations. Farmers who can no longer grow enough to eat now have to work as porters for trekkers who hike through the Himalayas. Many young people are simply leaving to find work elsewhere.
Now, The community members are going to change job.
Now the community members are going to change jobs. Some are going to truckers. Some are going to go to Gulf countries. Some are going to India. And some are to do government service.
Villages like this one, which sit atop the Himalayas, are warning signs. As the Himalayan glaciers melt and rivers dry up, scientists warn that communities from Afghanistan to India to China to Vietnam will also have to adjust. For the World Vision Report, this is Jared Ferry in Dunche, Nepal.
Someone's come up with a rather extraordinary solution to melting glaciers. Reporter Ben Arnoldy came across him on a trip through Ladakh in northern India.
He's an 80-year-old retired civil engineer, and he came up with the idea one winter of creating artificial glaciers, which sounds kind of crazy, but he's already proven this can be done. His biggest glacier was 2 kilometers long, and the whole idea of it is to create a glacier that would be at a low elevation. So he builds these glaciers just right above each of the villages, and so these will melt early in the spring, and that early spring water that the farmers are desperately needing will be there.
How exactly does one build a glacier?
You basically take the water that you get in the late fall and early winter, which is running off from the glacier, the real glaciers up higher up. You take that water because it's coming to you at a time when you don't need it for farming. You sort of divert it and pool it into these holding ponds above these villages. And so when the coldest temperatures of the winter come, these ponds freeze and sort of interconnect. What you end up with is this big glacier.
And what is the name of this engineer?
His name is Mr. Chuang Norful. He was just a wonderful man. I mean, he's over 80 years old, and he's rock hopping across little streams, incredibly agile and just full of life. And he loved showing, you know, the project.
How many people are actually benefited from his glaciers?
He's building one right now in a village of about 100 families. He's built over 20 glaciers before this.
Really? In the same region?
In the same region. And I think most of these villages are essentially that size, maybe a little bigger. He's helped thousands of people.
Boy, I bet he's a real hero in that area, at least for the farmers.
Yeah, when we were there looking at what he was doing at this one village, there happened to be another Ladakhi with us who was coming along. And what he was doing, he was from another village, and he was there to learn how to do this for his village. Mr. Norfolk is a big believer in training the local farmers on how to do this themselves. He was saying that before Mr. Norfolk came and created the glacier, the farmers were in the situation where there just simply was not enough water to grow the food they needed to feed the whole village. And it was sort of a desperate situation. And when the artificial glacier was put in, it returned the situation back to the way it used to be when the glaciers were much lower in elevation.
Okay, well, this is a really interesting story on artificial glaciers. Thank you for sharing this story from your trip with us, Ben.
My pleasure.
Ben Arnoldy covered this story for the Christian Science Monitor. You can find his article on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And this week, we have something new for you on our website, a photo essay. This one tells the story of global warming through dramatic photos of African landscapes. Independent writer and photographer David Snyder took the pictures in Tanzania and Kenya. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. Collecting water is serious business in Kaskakot, Nepal. Reporter Laura Sparrow found that out when she spent 9 months living with a family in the tiny farming village. There's always a lot of work to do around the house, but because Kaskakot has no plumbing, fetching water occupies a lot of the women's time. Now, getting water might seem pretty straightforward, but looks can be deceiving. Laura sent us this reporter's notebook on the rules of fetching and carrying water in Kaskakot.
The water tap closest to our house is a small concrete pen with a spout protruding from a rock. There's usually a scattering of people, mostly women and girls chattering nonchalantly around a cluster of tin jugs. But don't be deceived. This is a battleground. Now, there are rules.
Rule number one, you must adhere at all times to a strict system of maneuvering. It works like this. As I arrive, I set down my tin jugs close to the spout, but not too close. Confident, but not cocky. I am now in line. Rule number two, there is no line. It's a virtual line where everyone takes note of who has arrived when. Still, your place must be defended as your turn approaches by moving closer to the spout, vigilantly, but not presumptuously. Rule number three, the virtual line is enforced through joint regulation. We watch for cheaters who move their jugs in too close, too quickly. Cheaters are handled with varying degrees of severity, depending on their age, status, and ferocity. I lack all three of these advantages, so for me, outright cheating is not an option. However, that brings us to rule number four. Tactical alliances may be arranged. This is my specialty. Let's say an aggressor places their water jug under the spout when it's my turn. I exchange glances with, say, Lakshmi, the girl who does housework for the school headmaster. Lakshmi climbs up behind the water spout, thereby monopolizing access, and then shouts, "Laura, Didi, sister!" as if my name is a football play. I hand her my water jug, and she hooks it right under the spout until the offender has removed their vessel from underneath it. And then, to prove a point, when my jug is full, I hand Lakshmi hers, so that there's never an opening for challenge. Then we declare victory and walk home together while the old ladies yell after us. Rule five is the trickiest. The water tap involves all kinds of unspoken social conventions that are completely invisible to the uninitiated. For example, you may find, as I did on a particularly busy day, that just as you arrive, a woman will begin to yell at you in a furious tumble of incomprehensible words. And you may think, quite correctly, I am in full accordance with the system of maneuvering, as you make your way, at the proper speed, towards the water spout. But then, the woman will take a palmful of water and toss it into your face for no reason whatsoever. Back at the house, Amma is waiting for me, and I cry indignantly that her only American daughter has been mistreated at the water tap. Amma sighs and then explains, I must have stood too close to low caste water jugs, and in the Hindu caste system, water is a conductor of impurity. The tainted object, in this case, me, can be cleansed with a sprinkling of water that has touched gold, such as an earring. Our neighbor had been looking out for my high-caste Brahmin family by purifying the foolish foreign water girl. So much for the system. Some rules can only be learned on the job.
Laura Sparrow lived in Cascacote in 2003 when she volunteered as a teacher. Now she's a freelance reporter based in New York, but she still returns to Cascacote and her adopted family every year. Coming up, in Liberia, the wheels of justice grind to a halt, literally. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Liberia, rape cases rarely make it to court. Victims are usually too poor to pay for transportation to a medical clinic or to court. And police officers have no way of getting to crime scenes so they can investigate. For the past year, an organization in northern Liberia called EQUIP has been providing the wheels of justice. Bonnie Allen reports.
A young girl sits quietly at a taxi stand in the middle of Tabata, a large village in northeastern Liberia. Sweat slowly drips down her cheek. The 8-year-old girl has been sitting in the same spot for 3 days, waiting for a ride to the hospital to get a rape exam. We'll call the girl Mary to protect her identity. She says a 16-year-old neighbor boy raped her after school. He said if I didn't come inside his house, she tells me, he'd beat me. I said no, but then he dragged me inside the room. Then he shoved a cloth in my mouth. Mary's father is determined to get his daughter medical treatment. A high school science teacher, he spent all of his savings, $20 US, to hire a taxi from their small village, and that only got them halfway to the hospital. He needs another $20 to travel 2 hours to the next city.
I reported this to the national police. They said there is no money to transport the victim. So they said I should take the initiative to transport my daughter, the victim, to second pier. We are stranded.
He's not the only one stranded. At the Tapita police station, the man in charge, Inspector Morris Dolly, says his police officers have no way of going to Mary's village to investigate the crime.
The police here don't have a vehicle. We don't have a vehicle at all. It's very bad.
This northern part of Liberia is a logistical nightmare for crime victims and police. 14 years of civil war destroyed infrastructure such as roads. It also wiped out police resources. There are 500,000 people living here in Nimba County, spread out in villages deep in the dense rainforest. Yet there are only 170 police officers. And they share just one vehicle and two motorcycles. But there is one local organization that for the past year has been acting as the wheels of justice. It's called Equip Liberia, and its field office is Transportation Central, with 15 motorcycles and a four-wheel drive truck. Program Director Mark Trapesky explains how Equip gets people to wherever they need to go.
Moving police to where they need to go to facilitate arrests, moving court officers to retrieve witnesses, and also moving survivors to medical and psychosocial treatment facilities and to the different court proceedings that they need to be present at in order for a case to move forward.
Equip has been the driving force, literally, behind 700 cases in the past year. Almost 40% of them involved rape or violence against women.
Investigation is true. That's one. It should be counseling. It's very important.
At the Equip office in Ganta, Mark Trapesky stands in front of a room full of national police officers. Part of his job is to train them how to help rape victims get access to different services. And when the topic of transportation comes up...
So maybe you guys can tell me, what do you normally do when you have to move a survivor to the hospital?
You contact Equip.
You contact Equip, that's true.
The police officers laugh, but then shake their heads. They know most crime victims in Liberia get very little or no help. Astor Bella knows that too. The hefty woman fries fish outside her mud hut near the Guinea border. Her 3-year-old granddaughter sleeps on a dusty mat nearby. The young girl was raped in May. Cases such as this are actually quite common here. The majority of rape victims in Liberia are juveniles. Incredibly, 10% are under the age of 5. Last month, Equip made sure the girl, her grandmother, and a witness made it to court an hour's drive away.
Equip used to bring a car here to transport me. They cared for me and gave me food because I don't have any support. I was crying for help with this little girl suffering from pain. Equip got involved and did everything for me. They transported me 6 times. Sometimes, when there was no car, they paid my way to go and come.
In the end, a 34-year-old man was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. It's a remarkable outcome in a country where rape is rarely prosecuted.
They largely have gone unpunished for the past 20 years. They've largely gone uninvestigated for the past 20 years. And so as a consequence, people feel like they can get away with it, and as a consequence of that, they're more likely to perpetrate crimes like this in the future.
The files I have here are getting bigger and bigger day by day.
Trapesky flips through a tall stack of court files. He beams with pride as he points out each conviction.
Across Liberia, Equip only operates in Nimba County, and Nimba County is the only county that's consistently reporting convictions for rape cases and murder cases. Just this year, with this project, they've had 10 convictions for rape, whereas in the rest of Liberia, if you add all of the cases together, it doesn't reach to 10, which is a fairly phenomenal statistic.
Trapesky's smile disappears when he talks about the future. The transportation program is slowing down and is set to end soon. That's why Equip is not helping Mary, the young girl waiting for a ride back in Tapita. Equip has been funded by the United States Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, but it no longer considers Liberia a disaster zone, so this program no longer qualifies for emergency funding. Back in Tapita, Mary's father says that even though he can't even afford to get his daughter to a hospital, police have asked him to pay for transporting her alleged rapist to pretrial detention.
I'm not going to do it. That's the police work.
But if that doesn't happen, the man will simply be released and the case forgotten. Mary's father, a tall, dignified-looking man, finally scrapes together $20 from friends and relatives to pay for a taxi to the clinic. It's a lot of money, enough to feed a family in Liberia for a month. Mary sits on her mother's lap as the small yellow car bounces along pothole-ridden roads.
What happened before your car from Towestown, your car here? What happened to your car?
Now people rape me.
People rape you? How it happened?
Once there, midwife Rosaline Sanduo gently questions Mary. Then she snaps on rubber gloves and tries to make the frightened girl comfortable. Mary lies on a leather-padded exam table. It's taken an entire week for her to get here, so she's wearing a different dress and she's taken a bath. Still, as the midwife examines the girl, she says internal cuts reveal she has indeed been raped. So now here's the problem. Mary's father had enough trouble getting here. If the case makes it to trial, he would need to get his daughter to the courthouse. It's twice as far and even more expensive. 5 hours by taxi. But he's determined.
I want to see that perpetrator is brought to justice. So I will force my way. Transportation is my problem now. You see, I'm pushed against the wall. I don't know.
That means Mary may never have a chance at justice. For now, the young girl clutches her clinic report and crams into a rickety old taxi to make the long trip back to her remote village. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Nimba County, Liberia.
The Nobel Peace Prize concert on December 11th featured artists from all around the world. Amadou and Mariam, the duo from Mali, were part of the lineup. This is their music. Amadou Bagayoko and Mariam Doumbia are known as the blind couple from Mali. Famous for mixing musical styles and instruments from all over the world, the couple, who have been married for almost 30 years, have really hit the big time now. They recently opened for the British band Coldplay on their European tour. We spoke about Amadou and Mariam with our global guide to all things music, Ish Mafundiko. Welcome back to the show, Ish.
Thanks, Peggy. It's great to be back.
Let's talk a little about Amadou and Mariam. I think they're now in their 50s, but they started off many years ago. Tell us about that, if you would.
Amadou Bagayoko and Mariam Doumbia, we're both child prodigies, and both of them are blind. Mariam, by the time she was six, she was dancing at wedding parties and baptisms. By age two, Amadou was playing all kinds of percussion, and by the time he was 10, he was already playing harmonica and flute, and in his teens, he picked up his real love, which is the guitar. And then they met at the Bamako Institute of the Young Blind in the 70s.
And they both loved music, and I guess that drew them together.
Yeah, absolutely. Their love for music brought them together, and one thing led to another. In 1980, they were married.
And they've been playing music ever since.
In 1998 is when their breakthrough single, Mon Amour Ma Cherie, was released. And that really opened doors for them.
And that Mon Amour Ma Cherie is a good example of Malian blues, which is what they specialized in, kind of blues music with guitar and voices.
Initially, that's what it was. It was just the guitar and some percussion and the voices. But then after Mon Amour Ma Cherie, they moved in other directions. But I think Mon Amour Ma Cherie is a good example of Malian blues. Uh, They were singing in French and Bambara, their vernacular language, which I do not understand, unfortunately.
Was that song a big hit in West Africa?
It was a big hit in West Africa and also in Europe. And I think all over the world, actually, to world music lovers. I think that was my introduction to Amadou and Mariam. They appeared on an album called From Mali to Memphis, released by Putumayo.
Hmm. So did you ever hear this couple in concert-ish?
Unfortunately, no, but I actually saw them at some festival where they were supposed to play, but I was
really?
Leaving it the day before they played, and I saw them walking around, the two of them together. They looked really beautiful.
You say that Mon Amour Ma Cherie opened doors for Amadou and Mariam. What were some of the doors that it opened? What happened as a result of that song?
After it became a hit, they went all over the place performing, and I think they caught the ear of Manu Chao, he's the Spanish world music star, and he sought them out and worked with them on an album called Dimanche Bamako, which is Sunday in Bamako, and he produced the album, he collaborated with them, and by that time they'd also really widened their horizons in terms of their music, and they sort of mixed what was basically Malian music by adding Syrian violins, Cuban trumpets, Egyptian ney, Colombian trombones, Indian tablas, and dogon percussion. So it became a very global sound.
Truly, truly world music at that point.
Absolutely.
Let's listen to something from that album.
Yeah, why don't we listen to Fast Food Dhaka, which I really like.
Sénégal, cinéma, le Paris. Demain je serai parti. La gare Dakar, Bamako, mon petit, y a pas de problème. Tout va bien, aujourd'hui je me marie. J'ai confiance, amour, solo, Gao, l'Algérie, Tunisie, Italie. Y a pas de problème, j'aime au Manhattan, fast food, Dakar. Sénégal, cinéma, le Paris. Ascenseur pour le ghetto, il est minuit à Tokyo. Il est 5 euros.
I'm wondering how that affected their careers.
Absolutely, sold more than 300,000 copies and went platinum, as you said, and then things just started happening for them. And as you might have noticed, that music is very happy music that you can dance to, so it really appealed to a lot of people. And in 2006 they co-wrote and performed the Soccer World Cup anthem. The World Cup was held in Germany that year, and they recorded it with Herbert Grönemeyer, a German artist, and it went all the way to the top of the German charts. And they all,
really?
Yes, and they really did the summer festival circuit as well in Europe and in the United States. They really became big.
Put them on the map for sure.
Absolutely. When you think of soca as the number one sport in the world, so everybody really had that tune, everybody who followed the World Cup that year.
Ish, Amadou and Mariam have a new album out now. Can you tell us anything about it?
Welcome to Mali is the last album by Amadou and Mariam. And for it, they won the 2009 Song Lines Best Group Award, which is another big recognition for them, another milestone for the duo. And it features collaborations with a whole bunch of musicians.
Well, why don't we listen to the song Sabali from that new album, Welcome to Mali?
It was the first single from off that album, and it was very, very big, a very, very popular song.
Chérie, je m'adresse à toi. Avec toi, chérie, la vie est belle.
this is a very different sound. It starts out with very simple instrumentation and clear vocals, and then you got that synthesizer, which is kind of going up and down the scale. It's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a very catchy tune.
Is there something else-ish that we should listen to from this album to get a real good feel for what they're doing now?
On the album, Welcome to Mali, they collaborated with Kanan, the Somali rapper that we actually featured on the show a few weeks ago. And they did a track called Africa, on which Kanan talks about it being an East Coast, West Coast collaboration, which sort of echoes American rap, you know, the West Coast, East Coast thing in American rap. It's kind of funny.
Okay, well, Ish, we're going to go out on that song, Africa. And we thank you again so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Peggy. It's always fun being on the show.
Here we go.
Ish Mafundakwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. Ish mentioned that Amadou and Mariam are an amazing looking couple. You can see for yourself. There are a couple of photos of them on our website.
It's just a jolly scene if it's for you and me.
Dancing to the drumbeat of home, even when home is 1,600 miles away. That's next on the World Vision Report.
You take me somehow up and then you let me down.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Cambridge, Massachusetts is 1,600 miles north of Haiti. But on one busy side street in the town, it sounds like Haiti is much closer. So close, you can hear a tidal wave of drum beats tumbling out of a third-floor window. It's the live music for a weekly Haitian dance class. The teacher is determined to preserve the dance and music of his homeland. And he goes one step further. He travels back to Haiti every summer to teach dance to young people there. Chris Burrell has this story from downtown Cambridge.
The collective body heat of more than 60 dancers makes this studio feel as muggy as a terrarium, and the band is about to turn up the heat even more. Shoulders dip and knees bend to the beat. Donna Mars is one of the students vying for floor space today.
I love learning more about my Haitian heritage. The dancing is very sensual. Also, you have to feel the music, listen to the beat of the drum to actually know, you know, the movement. Jean Paulo is a great teacher. He's so enthusiastic about his culture and about his craft that he makes you want to come like every weekend.
And 1, 2, 3, 4. Roll down, 1, 2, 3, 4. Bend the knees, 1, 2, 3, 4.
In my class, I always start with a warm-up because the warm-up is very good for the technique of the class, because Haitian dance is very grounded. You're always in a bent knee. You're always doing high jumps.
Instructor Jean Apollon models the moves for his students. A smile crosses his boyish face as he thrusts his hips and legs forward. Dance has been Apollon's passion since childhood. He won a scholarship to a dance program in Port-au-Prince, where he was born, but had to sneak off to take it because his parents wanted him to pursue sports.
I told them that I was, you know, going to volleyball practice, so I take a pile of dance clothes, hide it in my bag.
What he saw and felt there as a 10-year-old hooked him for life.
The first day I went and see drums in front of me and they started to play, it was like you went straight to heaven. It was a house of joy.
The joy is what Apollon wants to recapture by reviving his country's traditional dance and music, a cultural heritage all but lost because of Haiti's political and economic turmoil.
There is no more interest in the culture. It's sad because it's really unjust.
His sadness is also rooted in personal tragedy. Apollon was only 14 when violence erupted in the wake of a military coup that toppled former leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide. On a January morning in 1991, his father walked out of their house to see if the streets were safe enough to take Jean and his siblings off to school. They weren't.
Suddenly we saw hundreds of people coming in towards the house with machetes, and I saw body parts in their hands, but I didn't know if it was my father. A lot of people in the neighborhood who knew us were like, oh, they're killing your father, you need to do something. But we were scared because we didn't know where to go.
A couple years later, Apollon fled to America and stayed away from Haiti and the traumatic memories it stirred up. But about 5 years ago, he mustered the courage to return.
And do something for Haiti. Because I know there are kids who are in the same predicament that I suffered in Haiti. Because there are a lot of other kids who had their father, mother, all the entire family killed also in Haiti.
So for the past 3 summers, he and another dancer have traveled to Haiti to teach dance for free. But they soon learned that their young students needed something vital before they could even begin to twist and leap to drum beats.
Oh, so it's when I went outside to get some water, and I saw 4 of them sitting down sharing a piece of meat. And we just realized that, you know, these kids are malnourished. So we went to the bank and we got money and we're just starting to feed them.
Back in the studio, Jean reaches up his arms, then folds over at the waist as he limbers up his students for a dance called the Ibo, all about breaking the chains of slavery.
Music! Music, let's go!
Class regular, Haitian-born Miriam Midi, praises Apollon for preserving dances like the Ibo.
This is a piece of our culture that we want to keep alive, because I always felt in my heart that it was such a shame that such a beautiful thing was going to be lost.
After class, throngs of exhausted students reach out to Apollon for a hug. It's the embodiment of the bridge he wants to build between Haiti and America, and the reason he named his foundation that teaches dance in Haiti, Jambé, which in Creole means crossing.
Even though we're not from the same culture, some of us are same country, to just really be there for each other and build that community. Having this kind of meeting in my class and be able to go around and talk to people really kind of give me that reassurance that we can definitely have a community again. Have some sense of who we are as human beings.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Chris Burrell in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And to see photos of the Haitian dancers, click on Chris's story on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You'll find the link there. Many of those poor kids that dance teacher Jean Apollon was talking about live on the streets of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Reporter Amelia De Sosa had an encounter with one of them. She tells us about it in this reporter's notebook.
It's a day like any other on Delmont Boulevard, a congested four-lane thoroughfare that cuts through Port-au-Prince. I sit behind the wheel and stare out the windshield at the long line of cars inching slowly uphill. Suddenly, a boy's face appears at my passenger window. He has one eyebrow raised and he's pointing at the filthy hood of my car. I know this kid. He's one of the legions of children who dart and weave between the cars on the burnt-out blacktop of Delma, scrounging for cash. At the car in front of me, a small shoeless boy hangs on the side-view mirror begging for change, and to my left, another boy balances on the traffic median, selling cigarettes and gum. His clothes are rags, faded to the color of ash. Many Haitians see these children as a scourge. The reality is, they are among the poorest of the poor, with no social safety net to catch them. But the car wiper who's appeared at my window seems different. He looks directly in my eyes and smiles like I'm an old friend. I wave both hands, trying to tell him I don't want him to wipe my car. But he just blinks at me with both eyes and smiles more. As he sweeps his rag over the car, I can see that he is genuinely trying to remove every smudge of dirt from the finish. I lift my hands in the air as if to tell him I don't have any money, which isn't true. He just shrugs and finishes wiping down the car anyway. Then he smiles at me through the window and mimes the words, "some other time," and saunters back to the next car in line. I am stunned. I have never had this happen before. A kid on the street gives me something for free,
then walks away smiling. And I feel ashamed at myself for being so cheap. I beep my horn a few times, and the guy raises his hand in the air. He trots over to my car and flashes that smile again. I've never been comfortable giving children on the street money. Aid workers say it only encourages more children begging. But this time I can't help it. I hand him a few bills. And I can't help asking him what he will do with the money. He says he's trying to pay for school. His dream is to be a mechanic one day because he loves working on cars. Then he flashes his smile one more time and walks away. That two-minute conversation shocks me. I realize that years of living in Haiti have conditioned me to not see street children anymore. But with a few candid words, this kid has reached into my car and touched me. Maybe it's because he comes across more like a Boy Scout doing good deeds for society than a child clinging to the margins of it. He's got dignity, and he's fighting to make it through this exhausted city where there is no water, no food, and no work. Almost everybody else on this sweltering street looks crushed, but this boy is holding his head high and doing the best he can, which in his case is wiping down the hoods of cars while dreaming of something better. I watch him in the rearview mirror as he approaches the next car, his hand holding his dirty rag in the air like it's asking a question, and I realize that he's walking away with more than just a few dollars from me. He's leaving with my respect.
That was Amelia de Sosa in Haiti. It's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, but Haiti has a rich musical scene. All kinds of music pours out of open car windows and onto the streets. Here's one of the top 10 favorites right now. It's called Après Toi. That's Après Toi, sung by the Haitian singer La Rose.
Today, President Mandela takes office in Pretoria, balancing black aspirations with white fears.
Remember this day, boys. This is a day our country went to the dogs.
Brothers, sisters, this is the time to build our nation. All of the whites are cheering for South Africa. All of the blacks are cheering for England. How long before the World Cup?
That's a scene from the movie Invictus. It's just opened in theaters across the U.S. this week. It's about former South African President Nelson Mandela, who's trying to unite his fractured country around a World Cup rugby game. The film was shot in South Africa, a favorite location for Hollywood film scouts. But huge Hollywood movies aren't the only films being made at the tip of Africa. There's a thriving local movie market, too. I checked in with Busi Dlamini in Johannesburg. We talk to her from time to time on the show, and she's a huge movie fan. Busi, good to talk to you again.
Hi, Peggy.
So, Busi, what changes have you seen recently in the movie industry there in South Africa?
Well, one of the things that's been interesting is the fact that for a while we'd have like two major films being made in a year, you know, and a lot of those got international acclaim and they were great, but a lot of times they were not that accessible to the local audience or not entirely relevant in some cases. So the shift has been that movies are becoming more relevant, more exciting, and speaking to our day-to-day lives.
Can you give me an example of a movie you've seen recently that would illustrate that, that exemplifies these changes?
Well, there's a movie that's called Umalusi. And in English, that would mean the shepherd. I'm not sure, you know, why they chose that title. And that's something that's also interesting, the shift in language in terms of movie. For a long time, movies were geared towards an international audience and predominantly, therefore, in English. So movies are starting to become more in vernacular languages. So this one in particular is in Xhosa. It's one of the local languages in South Africa. So it's set in a small town in the Eastern Cape, also shifting from sort of predominant movies being in big cities. So it gives us a glimpse of what life in smaller cities is. And it follows the life of a young man who's from an affluent family that's from the townships but has now moved on, you know, so the movie, the rags to riches story, but slightly inverted as well. So he gets into trouble, and in running away from his family, he goes to his extended family in the township and gets a glimpse of the real life of what ordinary South Africans experience as well.
It's interesting because you said the films in the past have mostly connected with an international audience. I'm wondering, when you went to see this film, could you tell from the reaction of the people sitting in the theater how they responded to it in comparison with movies made in the past?
Completely. I mean, I think most people were like almost on the floor rolling with laughter at some things that were actually quite serious, but it's in the way they were told, you know, and I think our daily lives are both painful, but also life, you know, people love, people laugh.
Is there a common theme or storyline that runs through the uniquely South African films? What kind of story are these films telling?
At the moment, I think the huge topic that's happening is the divide, both culturally, but also the economic divide that's happening. So as much as the transformation in South Africa has taken place, and there's people that are probably economically sort of more advanced than they were 10 years ago, it is creating a gap. So I think movies are space, you know, for the country to start interrogating itself around that.
Are you talking economically, or are you talking racially, or both?
No, economically. I think for a long time, obviously, South Africa, having the history it's had, you know, the economic divide's been predominantly racially divided. But we're starting to see more and more sort of black middle class rising up. So the economic divide is actually almost as prevalent, if not more so, than the racial divide.
All right, Busi Dlamini, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the South African movie scene. We'll check in with you again.
Thank you, Peggy.
Busi Dlamini lives in Johannesburg, South Africa. And we end our show today with A Globe at a Glance and another song. This one's called Beds Are Burning. It was originally recorded in 1987 by the Australian band Midnight Oil. It became a huge hit, reaching the top 10 in countries like England, France, and the Netherlands. The song was written as an apology to Aboriginal people for the way they'd been treated by the Australian government. Just 2 months ago, the song was brought back into service by none other than Kofi Annan, former UN Secretary General, and now president of the Global Humanitarian Foundation. The song is part of the foundation's Tick, 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 Time for Climate Justice campaign.
Tick, tick, tick.
60 musicians and celebrities participated, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Bob Geldof, Nobel Prize economist Mohamed Yunus, and others. The song was rewritten to draw attention to the global warming crisis that's being discussed at the UN conference in Copenhagen this week. And that's our Globe at a Glance. It's also the end of our show. Just a reminder, we have a web special this week, photos and narration by David Snyder on his recent trip to East Africa. Go to worldvisionreport.org. You can sign up for a podcast while you're there, if you'd prefer to listen in your own time. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Chris Baldig is our production assistant, and I'm Peggy Waymeyer.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Sacha culpi.